And and unfortunately, it's been laid upon me by both Forrest and some other libertarians here to take on the role of Messiah or prophet tonight and point the way out of the gathering gloom, which has been. I don't think I'm not going to try and make it my mission to convert people to optimism tonight. or to point the way out. I'm going to just try to explain why I'm optimistic, and maybe some of this will rub off. It's a peculiar thing for me because it's in so many ways both a factually and an analysis of the present system. Thanks a lot. Except I'm very close to Forrest, and in other ways we're far apart, and it's a peculiar kind of symbiotic relationship. At any rate, I'm not the reason. Well, let me start this way. And the reason I'm not worried about the Bill Marina's Confucian freezing, which is, I guess, similar to the way to Forrest's analysis, is I think. I mean, it's been true that throughout history, as Forrest said this morning, despotism, statism, caste system, etc., has been the norm in civilizations. How they got that way is something which I don't know that much about. I think I have read a little bit about ancient Sumeria, the first great civilization, and according to Samuel Kramer, the great Sumerologist, Sumerian civilization started as a free market kind of situation, free society, free market kind of orientation, and then the society freezes up, and apparently from what you can get out of the literature, obviously we don't know that much about specific processes of ancient civilization. Apparently, what happens is that the voluntary defense agency, which happened to be also the temple, which was built on the top of a hill in ancient Sumeria. It was sort of a combination of like vertical integration or horizontal integration, whatever you call it. The temple was also the fort. So when the tribes came marauding in from outside Sumeria, everybody would take refuge in the temple, and the temple organization, the priests, would also perform the military defense function. Apparently, as the centuries continued, there's more and more problem from marauding tribes, and the temple began to become a permanent military garrison state kind of situation, exacting taxes, et cetera, and we're into the state. At any rate, maybe that's one model of how Oriental despotism originates. But at any rate, they certainly tend to freeze in, and they tend to continue on for a long, long time. What causes them to degenerate, to disintegrate? Well, it could be many reasons. It could be because the Roman Empire perhaps overtaxed itself, overtaxed the subjects, and new tribes come moving in, or perhaps climatic changes. Apparently, many ancient civilizations were going along very nicely until suddenly, bingo, the rain disappears or whatever, and they've had it. At any rate, it seems to me that it's true that Western civilization over the last several hundred years is this great burst of free society or free market and so forth, and individual liberty. But I think this is not a cause for pessimism. One could easily be pessimistic just on that score and say, well, looking at the history of the human race, libertarian and free market and prosperity in general, high standard of living, etc., is really only a sort of a pimple on the human history. However, I think there's a qualitative change has occurred, which makes the Confucian model, so to speak, obsolescent. In other words, which leads to a epistemological or historiographical optimism. And the quantum change basically is the Industrial Revolution. Let me put it this way: the model, the paradigm we can look at, Oriental despotism, let's say. You have the peasants, essentially agricultural society, of course. You have the peasants who are down there sweating down on the rice paddies or the wheat fields or whatever, and they're overseen and supervised by a giant bureaucracy with a king at the top. And the bureaucracy, the power elite, extracts the everything above subsistence from the peasants, shoots it up to the top, and creates this power elite, wealth and civilization, and gold and all you know, damask or whatever, tapestry, and all the stuff that we see in the movies, you know, about the ancient empires. And down there is the galley slaves and the peasants dying at the age of 20 and all that sort of stuff. Well, this sort of system, which we can call Oriental despotism, is a monstrous, evil, horrible system from the libertarian point of view. However, it's viable in the sense that it can continue on indefinitely. There's no mechanism in the system to necessarily lead to its overthrow. So I think if I were around, if any libertarian was around in ancient China, we could be pretty. You know, it would be legitimate to be fairly pessimistic about the chances for for changing society and so forth. And one might well look for forests, you know, escape hatch down the Yangtze or wherever, and get out. But I think, in my view, a fantastic qualitative change occurs with the Industrial Revolution. And the really amazing thing are the guys who made the Industrial Revolution. In other words, the 17th and 18th century classical liberals, they didn't have nearly as cause to be as optimistic as we do. And the fact that they were optimistic and felt that they could bust through the mercantilist and guild system, et cetera, was high testimony to their courage and faith in what they could accomplish. Okay, we get the Industrial Revolution, which starts around mid-18th century, continues on approximately to the mid-19th as the first great burst. And with this, we have a complete change in the viability of social systems. Because we have the irreversibility of technology, of the industrial system developing, of a fantastically increased standard of living for the masses. Not so much for the guys on top. The king is, you know, more or less, the king pegged along pretty well in the old days, before the Industrial Revolution. So it's the mass of the population now has clothes to wear and a place to eat that's not in the same room with the pigs and that sort of stuff. It's true, the masses of the, you know, the peasants from the before the Industrial Revolution were living in one room hut with the pigs. At any rate, so you have this enormous quantum change, a qualitative change in conditions, and you have also what's called an unfortunate name, the revolution of rising expectations. But what it really means is nobody's now going to settle. Nobody's going to settle for the old pre-industrial kind of system. So that every social group, with the possible exception of the current anti-technology crazies, I don't really take them very seriously. Like they always go off to the woods with the hi-fi sets and so forth under their arm. So whichever camp you're talking about, whether it's right wing, left wing, communist, new left, et cetera, across the board, every group is committed, ideologically committed, and personally committed to continuing an industrial system, to continuing a high standard of living for the masses, or a fairly high standard of living for the masses, and after all, we have this enormous population which we couldn't have had in a pre-industrial system. If we went back to the land and the communes and all that sort of stuff and scrap technology, maybe a couple of people would be left, but 99% of the world population would die off. So we're locked in to an irreversible technological industrial commitment to technological industrial revolution. Well, given this, there's our sort of free will choice in that sense, where we choose, everybody, I think every group chooses or hopes to continue an industrial system and to even expand it. The Marxists, for example, as utopian and kooky as they are committed also to expanding industrialism until the point where we have a Garden of Eden and there's no scarcity. Of course, we're not going to have that. The point is that they too are committed to an expanding industrial system. Given that commitment, which I think is almost universal, then the only possible system which could maintain and make an industrial system viable is the free market and free society. In other words, basically libertarian world. So the libertarianism becomes not only moral, not only the best thing from a moral principle point of view, it also becomes the only viable system to maintain the society and civilization and the standard of living and even pure survival for most of the populace. So in other words, with the Industrial Revolution, we have a fusion of moral principle and necessity, so to speak. both of which are now geared into the libertarian matrix. So, if we say that, then, and this means that all that we have to do, it makes the libertarian task much easier, because it means that to convince the public, the general public, or most of the public, or the thinking public, or whatever you want to call them, opinion molders, effective number of people to effect social change, all you really have to do, for this, at least in this basic sense, is to show them that you have to have free market, and you have to have a libertarian system to have the whole society and the whole civilization continue to be viable. So you don't have to necessarily convince them every detail of every moral principle, but you can show them that if you want to survive, if you want the country to survive or the world to survive, you have to go over to a libertarian free market setup. Now this, I think, is a powerful argument once the person is really convinced of this. And of course, the real question is, why should they be interested in the whole topic? Although it seems to me to be an interesting topic, whether the world is going to survive or not. But that people have other interests. And it's something that's sort of like, you have to slap a kid's face or something to focus his attention on what you want to tell him. There's a societal need for a bit of attention getting to focus his attention on. And then I'll get to that a little bit later. Necessity for attention calling. But the first people to realize this, and I think brilliant social philosophers who have almost been completely neglected among historians and social philosophers in general, because they were the first guys to see that industrialism made a big difference. In other words, it's all well and good to be a libertarian. I don't denigrate the early Enlightenment type of libertarians, but they were not dealing with industrial system. And they didn't see that industrialism brings in this extra argument for epistemological-historiographical optimism. Now, the first guy to really see this, I don't know who the first one was, but one of the first people was Jean-Baptiste Say, the great French economist, and his successor, I shouldn't be talking about this at all, because Leonard is a great expert on these two people, Charles Dunoyer and Charles Comte. Charles Comte is no relation, either ideological or personal, to Auguste Comte, the screwball takes over later. Charles Comte and Charles Dunoyer, as far as I know, Charles Comte and Charles Dunoyer have only been even mentioned by Elie Halevi in his very interesting work, The Era of Tyrannies, and Andrzejewski in passing, at least in English. But anyway, these are some of the first people to focus in on this whole question. Industrialism, if you're committed to industrial society, committed to industrial revolution, you have to have liberty. Even if you might not have to have it before, they weren't really interested in whether you had to have liberty before the Industrial Revolution. You certainly need it now, is essentially their point. And they began to analyze why this was true. They analyzed it largely from the economic point of view and also from the sociological point of view. And they were observing, of course, England being industrialized and France being industrialized, and they were thinking about that very seriously and in great depth. And they come up with heralding doomsday. let's not be a spiritual welfareist now. Okay, so what they did, but they began to analyze very deeply the whole, what happened? What was the essence of the pre-industrial system? What was the essence of the industrial system? What difference does the whole thing make? What has really been happening? And it was called the Dunoyer and Say, who originated what later came to be called class analysis. Now, of course, we think, in our present benighted age, we think of class analysis as being Marxist, commie. It was not originally Marxist or commie. It was originally libertarian. Not only was it libertarian, it was a key element of the libertarian ruling bloc. Essentially, what they said was that, and certainly even John Stuart Mill heralded these people. John Stuart Mill, I must admit, even though I'm not very congenial to his general temperament, that acknowledge a lot of these people who remained unjustly obscure. They saw that, they looked at the past epoch, and it was a pre-industrial epoch. What do they see? They saw essentially what you read in the Albert J. Nock book. They saw class domination, in other words, they saw a ruling class. And the analysis basically goes something like this. In Oriental despotism, you have the bureaucracy and the king on top, the emperor on top, constitutes the ruling class, peasants subjected underneath. Huh? What picnic? And a feudal society have the landlords who have come in as a ruling group and carved out different more decentralized areas of rule. So you have this concept of the ruling class as being the rulers. Now one of my major epistemological dash historiographical differences with Forrest is I think there is a them. And there is a ruling class at any given period, and they can be identified by historical or contemporary investigation. one of the problems is. Okay. Now McGoldrick is left, we can continue. Okay. let's see, what was I saying?
Class
ruler. I think one of the differences here is that I'm a methodological individualist. Meaning there ain't no such thing, when you get right down to it, as institutions or collectives or groups or societies or nations. That they're all only individual people. Of course, these individual people have played different roles and act as if they're collective things. And when dealing in common sense terminology, it's helpful to use these collective nouns as metaphors. But when you really get down to it, they're only individuals who will act, think, and so forth, and choose, and et cetera. So, of course, these individuals interact all the time. Nobody denies that. There's never been, incidentally, individualism has been smeared, of course, through history. And individualists are always said to believe that every individual is atomistic. It's the famous term, atomistic individualism. Every individual thinks that every individual is an atom sort of riding around in a vacuum and having no contact with anybody else. That, of course, no individualist, even the crazed Max Stirner, has really ever held that. So, it was the most extreme individual of all. So every individualist recognizes, of course, that individuals interact and learn from each other and affect each other and so forth and so on. But the point is that they're all, when you get that right down to it, only individuals and only they are around. So therefore, if this is true, that some individuals are getting a net out of any system, if there is a ruling class, and in any state's kind of set up, some individuals are getting a net balance advantage out of this state process, and others are on the losing end. One of the best political philosophers on this whole topic, by the way, is John C. Calhoun. I recommend his disquisition on government. Outside, of course, unfortunately, Calhoun happened to come from South Carolina, so he was a little wrapped up on the slave question, and deviated from libertarianism a bit on that. When we get him off the slave question, he was a brilliant libertarian thinker. One of the things he said more than 30 pages than most political scientists say in about 8,000. And one of the things he said there is given any state at all, even the most minimal functions and the most minimal form, degree of taxation, even the teeniest state in the world, you still have immediately a state, the very existence of a state generates class conflict. Now, how does it generate? Even if the state wants to be very libertarian, confine itself to the night watchman role and all that. Why is that? Because the very existence of taxes means that one set of the population is paying the taxes on net. The other set of population is what Calhoun, in a brilliant terminology, called consuming the taxes. So you have the net taxpayers on the one hand and net tax consumers on the other. And of course, some of these net tax consumers are kicking back a little bit into the till and so forth. But the point is, on net, they are just praxeologically, so to speak, just looking at it, just pure arithmetic. If one group is paying taxes on balance, somebody else is getting it. So Therefore, the existence of any state at all sets up class conflict. And the more power you give to the state, and the more functions the state takes on, the great more intense, the more aggravated the class conflict becomes, because you're fighting over a bigger share of the loot, bigger amount of loot to begin with. Take, for example, a bureaucrat. The bureaucrat receives, gets a $20,000 salary, let's say. He's working for his assistant commissioner in charge of stamping signia or whatever. And he pays taxes, supposedly like everybody else. See, the fiction is maintained that he pays taxes, that he kicks in $5,000 or whatever to the Internal Revenue Service. Actually, of course, he doesn't pay any taxes at all. He's getting $15,000 tax-free out of the system. The fiction that he pays taxes is purely an accounting device, because his entire income is derived from taxes. So the very existence of a state sets up this tax consumption, tax consumer versus taxpayer thing. And then, of course, when the state starts doing anything beyond the pure police function, it immediately sets up some more class conflict, more subsidies, and more privileges, and so forth and so on. So in any society, my view is, in any society, you have identifiable net tax gainers and net tax consumers. Some of them, of course, very big net tax consumers. Others are somewhere on the margin. And you have an identifiable, therefore, power elite or ruling class, whatever you want to call it. I think Brezhnev and Kosygin and whoever else is there, I've really forgotten their names because they don't have the colorfulness of Kuchi in the old days. They've sort of lost touch with the Kremlin. But, they're the top of the ruling class in Russia. And there are others, you can cut the thing off at somewhere in the upper bureaucracy. Okay, so the original ruling class analysis of Dunoyer, Comte, and Say, etc., the libertarian ruling class analysis, identify the ruling class as those people, whatever groups they happen to be, whether they're merchants, landlords, oriental despots, bureaucrats, or whatever, who have seized control of the state apparatus and are ruling the rest of the society through taxation. This definition of class, or ruling class, was a very precise one, and there was no problem with it. In other words, the ruling class are the guys who got control of the state. This quote, the later words, not in the same context, much more confused social theorist, Sockless Jerry Simpson, later in the late 19th century. Sockless Jerry, I would not endorse Sockless Jerry's social analysis. He didn't have theoreticians of great merit to advise him. But when he said one time there are two classes of people, said Sockless Jerry, the robbers and the robbed. That's the nub of the thing. And notice the difference between this and the Marxian class analysis. I'll mention that in a minute. Another thing. So Comte and Dunoyer also say that industrialism requires a free market, the free market established conditions for industrialization, and industrial system can only be maintained by continuing a free market, went through the whole analysis and predicted that if this free market principle continues and expands as it should, we will eventually get to what they call a classless society. What they meant by a classless society was a society without a ruling class, not a society without differences and without specialization, without division of labor, but a society without a ruling class in which, quote, the government of men will be replaced by the administration of things. This is supposed to be a quote from Karl Marx. It's not a quote from Karl Marx. It's a quote from our great libertarian theorists. What they meant by that was that the government will wither away because it's obviously unviable. And as it's demonstrated to be more and more unviable, that will wither away and the market will replace it. They also have another great quote, which I forgot, but in a similar line, another great supposedly Marxian quote is the Comte Dunoyer analysis of what will happen in the future libertarian society. Okay, so they set this up, and also the thing is that we begin to have this distinction, the great ideological party distinction, so to speak, in the early 19th century. Is essentially, and of course this is oversimplifying, but we've gotten to the stage, the last day is always the day of oversimplification, so we want to cut through to the truth. Is essentially what we have is the so-called party of the left. The party of the left is usans. This is my view of it. The party of the left is essentially the libertarians, quasi-libertarians, minimal government, as what a friend of mine calls minarchists. and so forth. These people were essentially interested. They wanted to press on to a free market, freer and freer market, and along with the free market comes individual liberty, separation of church and state, international peace, free trade, hard money, etc., etc., the whole business, the whole quasi-libertarian setup. That's the so-called left, or later be known as classical liberals or classical radicals. Now on the right, the bad guys, the enemy, were the conservatives, with a capital C, defenders of the old order, of the throne and altar, of a fixed caste, what I've mentioned before about intellectuals as bodyguards of the ruling class, etc. International warfare, high tariffs, fixed nobility, and so forth and so on. The what we can call the old order, capital O, capital O. And the classical liberals are the revolutionaries in the widest sense, who were smashing the old order from within and from without, and by various methods, sometimes violent, sometimes peaceful, depending on the situation. But the conservatives really developed conservatism as a reaction to the revolution, quotes of the late 18th, early 19th century. And so originally conservatism, as an explicitly reactionary attempt to smash this new upstart and go back to the old order. And Bonal and Nemestre and all these characters, essentially what they want to do is this, end the American, French, and industrial revolutions and go back to the good old days of throne and altar. My general interpretation of what happens later on with conservatism and also with the center, the vital center, what happens is that they begin to realize the right wing, in quotes, of that period, the classical rightists, put it that way, begin to realize that the jig is up. They ain't going to restore the old order. They're not going to get absolute monarchy back in the same form, because now we have industrialization to cope with. And you can't really say you got to smash industry. I mean, they try to do it, and the Factory Acts, for example, in England, were attempt by the Tory landlords to try to cripple the industrialists who are competing for the labor supply. They want to keep paying very low wages to the guys on the farms. They didn't like the people racing off and getting higher wage jobs in industry. But these things were basically, they realized that they had to transmute old-fashioned conservatism into some kind of new guise and accept this kind of new system, at least appear to accept the new system, accept industrialization, and accept democracy in some sense. The voting. Democracy originally was a libertarian kind of weapon. It was a weapon to get to at least have some say in a situation, along with the nobles, the king, and so forth. In this situation, classical liberalism is making sweeping victories all across the board. Sweeping victories not only because it's a mass movement. It's a movement designed telling the masses this is going to give you liberty and a higher standard of living and mobility and so forth and so on. An opportunity to break out of the caste and all the rest. And it's obviously working very well. I mean, it's paying off its promises pretty quickly. And old-fashioned conservatism is getting more and more discredited. Now, something happens around the mid-19th century. Several things begin to happen. One of the things begins, I mentioned about war, that classical liberalism hives off and becomes super patriotic and goes off on war adventures. Another thing that happens is that conservatism pops up again in a curious new guise known as socialism. Socialism is a very new kind of thing. It's one of the newest, classical liberalism and classical socialism, about the newest political philosophies. And I guess anarchism also. These things are all new early 19th century. And socialism is even newer, of course, than liberalism. And socialism appeals to a lot of people for various reasons. One, it's a new utopian thing, which really hasn't happened before, been advanced before on any kind of large scale, which is we're going to bring a second revolution. It's okay to have a liberal revolution, industrial revolution against the old order, and we're going to come to fulfill the promise of the old liberal revolution. We're going to bring in a new socialist revolution, which is going to bring everybody not only abundance, not only industrialism, which they're going to keep. I mean, they're frankly now saying, okay, we're going to keep industrialism, etc. But we're also bringing you something else, which is equality, uniformity, the end of specialization, division of labor, and so forth, all these kooky utopian goals. So we have this very peculiar blend of situation where the socialists are using to try to achieve classical liberal goals, such as peace, classless society, the liquidation of the government of men into the administration of things, industrialization, abundance, high standard of living for the masses, etc., and freedom, in quotes. The socialists proposed to achieve this by old-fashioned conservative means. It's a very peculiar kind of hybrid, because in other words, okay, they say we accept classical liberal goals, they're right, but we're going to bring you these goals, and by bringing back the good old conservative sense of belonging, as it's now called, community, caste kind of system, collectivization, statism from the top, and so forth and so on. So we have socialism begins as a hybrid, peculiar hybrid movement with a grave inner contradiction in it, which only becomes pretty evident later. Now, what happens on the Comte Dunoyer front is that one of Comte Dunoyer's disciples, during their high period was shortly after the Restoration period after Napoleon is beaten. One of their disciples is sort of a nutty old guy named Saint-Simon, who's sort of hanging around salons. And as far as I remember, reading Leonard's material, Saint-Simon never read anything, just sort of listened, you know, to parlor gossip. So he was a libertarian at that point. He was a free market libertarian. And then after some years, he sort of drifts away from the Comte Dunoyer circle and becomes something of a socialist. It's not very well known what he actually became, because he didn't really write much. And the Saint-Simonians who follow him are sort of much more socialistic than Saint-Simon. But anyway, it's through the fuzzy and confused mind of Saint-Simon that the libertarian class analysis filters down to the Saint-Simonians, who codify the whole thing and put it down around 1830. And the Saint-Simonians transmute by this whole process, this filtering through the fuzzy mind of Saint-Simon, the Saint-Simonian has changed the whole class analysis, make it really completely self-contradictory, but make it somehow more saleable. And the Saint-Simonian class analysis now becomes this: okay, we acknowledge that the ruling class back in the feudal period, the Oriental despotic period, was, you know, who you said it was. But now, when you get to the free market, when you get to classical liberalism, suddenly a new ruling class pops up, which has no relation to the state whatsoever. That's the employers, the businessmen, employers of labor. So all of a sudden you have the employer class as a ruling class over the workers by very virtue of the fact that employers are paying workers for their labor services. So in other words, what the Marxist-Leninist theory of class is a completely confused, self-contradictory amalgam of the old libertarian theory of the ruling class, which is he who controls the state, or that group which controls the state, blended in to the whole thing shifting completely when you get to the employer-employee relationship, but suddenly the employer, just by virtue of paying the worker for his services, becomes a ruler over him. And this is all mixed in, everything then, you know, follows them to the Marxian class theory. And then Karl Marx himself picks up the Saint-Simonian theory of class, and we're off to the races. And this is combined, and also the concepts such as administration of the government of men will be replaced by administration of things, these, and the classless society, these things which were originally strictly libertarian concepts, now become, left-wing utopian concepts, in the sense that now they become, well, first we're going to take over the state, the working class will take over the state because the working class is also oppressed, and then we'll smash everything, we'll eventually wind up with a classless society, meaning no division of labor, no specialization, everybody uniform, and no scarcity, and all the rest of the stuff, and you have a communal collective kind of thing, and so forth and so on. All this stuff is this new hybrid which is attached to the libertarian class analysis by the Marxists. Okay, so the meantime, this whole analysis that industrialism requires a free market continues on through the 19th century. Herbert Spencer was mentioned already here, and is one of the last people who really had this firmly. He called the two concepts of society the industrial society versus the military society. What he meant by the military society was essentially this statism, militarism, the old order. And the industrial society requires a free market. This whole analysis gets lost in the shuffle by the turn of the 20th century as laissez-faire begins to die out, laissez-faire thinkers begin to die out. But the actual reality of the situation is the free market requires, industrialism requires a free market, still continues on. The reality is not affected by the fact that the theoreticians have died out. What happens incidentally to the socialists, to the Marxists, at all times the Marxists are always confronted with a crutch, which is part of their inner contradiction. On one hand, the Marxists claim that they're in favor of a revolutionary smashing the state of the bourgeois state apparatus. On the other hand, they claim they want to take over the state and run the, you know, have a big statism before the withering away of the state, which might be for, you know, somewhere off in hundreds of years. And so usually when the crunch comes and Marxists arrive somewhere near the seat of power, there's a split off, and the left-wing Marxists still remain revolutionary, and the right-wing Marxists become something like, you know, Sidney Hook, who was a right-wing Marxist. In other words, they become part of the state apparatus. They become what later became known as Browderites. So you achieve this socialism by more and more accretions of state power, and eventually you'll have this great socialist system. So you have this constant splitting off in the Marxian world. Well, one of the things that happens is that statism begins to come in. Well, let me put it this way. One of the big problems with the fact, with this law of cause and effect, I believe there's a law of cause and effect, and we can analyze reality. And one of the things about the law of cause and effect is statist measures and increasing statism will make the system unviable, will make it unworkable, will ruin it. The problem is, however, it takes time. And it's not one of these immediate things. You know, when I take vitamin pills and I'm tired or something, I like to have the idea that when you take this vitamin pill and suddenly you pep up, you know, it's like some instant pill. I'm just taking this vitamin B pill and I'm raring to go. Of course, it doesn't work that way. There's a time element involved in cause and effect. In the social sphere, there's a big time element, big time lag. For one thing, laissez-faire, you know, virtual laissez-faire, relative laissez-faire, has built up in the United States and in Western Europe an enormous industrial machine, enormous capital investment. And so there's an enormous amount of play in the system. There's an enormous amount of looting zone, which the state could fasten onto and without visible deterioration for a long, long time. When you get to the to the late 19th century thinkers, libertarian or quasi-libertarian thinkers, they are very pessimistic. They are gloomy as all get-out, and with good reason. I mean, they might not be maybe they shouldn't have been epistemologically gloomy, but they certainly is as all hell historiographically gloomy, because they were at the beginning of this process. People like Spencer, Sumner, Pareto in Italy, who was essentially a libertarian but extremely pessimistic one, they look around them and they see the state closing in for the kill. And Pareto writes letters. Pareto started off as an aggressive young libertarian, and finally he sees that everybody's bad. Essentially, he was attacking the plutocracy, what was known then as plutocracy, the right-wing, mercantilist, big business statism, etc. And he thought that the labor unions were essentially his allies, because they were supposed to be against statism. And then he finds out the socialists are just as totalitarian, even more so than the businessmen, and he gives up. He doesn't see any hope for classical liberalism continuing. And then he does what one political scientist called retire to Galapagos, in a sort of spiritual sense. He just says, it's all hopeless, there'll always be a ruling class, and that's it. This has been wrongly interpreted as him favoring a ruling class. He was a libertarian who gave up. But there was some good reason for giving up, because the poor guys who were living around 1900 would look ahead of them and saw, and those who were more far-seeing than the others, saw statism advancing and encroaching, and saw no hope of any counteraction because all the laissez-faire people were dying out. And you have the Ely stuff that we've been talking about, and the Bismarckian influence and all the rest of it. All this stuff is growing. This is the big new thing, the big new fad. Then, of course, you have the Bolshevik Revolution, you have socialism, and so forth and so on. It looks like socialism is the wave of the future. If we could put I think it was Lincoln Steffens' famous remark, a great progressive muckraker visited Russia and came back and he said, I've seen the future and it works, a famous Steffens remark. Well, one of the things that happened, and one of the reasons why I'm optimistic, is this is now 70 years later, after our poor old confreres looking very gloomily at the future, and we've all seen the future and it doesn't work. In other words, just for us in the brilliant lines, the trouble with pragmatism is it doesn't work. We've seen that all these things don't work, and this is becoming more and more acceleratedly, if that's the word, evident, as in this current period. Now for some reason, I find this a very optimistic thing, and Forrest doesn't. But at any rate, in other words, what's happening here is that all these trends which are taking place, all these measures, higher taxes, inflation, the whole business, which Keynesian measures and cartelist measures, all these things which could apparently be gotten away with because there's so much fat in the system, so much fat that had been developed by the industrial system, by laissez-faire system, that it seemed like, it's like the myth of the What's that fable about the tower that is holding up the sky and keep chipping away at it and finally the whole thing collapses? And each chip looks as if it's completely unimportant. It doesn't really hurt the system. But now we're getting to the point where the system is being hurt. It's getting more and more obvious the system is being hurt. The system is collapsing. My mentor, Ludwig von Mises, called this in his book, Human Action, written in 1949, The Exhaustion of the Reserve Fund. What he meant by that is you have this reserve fund that has been built up by capitalism, by free market capitalism. This reserve fund is now being tapped, has been extracted more and more by socialist or statist measures. We're now getting to the point where the reserve fund is exhausted, and that means that the cause and effect will now be catching up the cause. In other words, the next chips, you know, chip away at the tower that holds up the sky, pretty soon the sky is going to start wobbling. The tower is going to wobble and the sky is going to start collapsing. Now this, what this means is we're beginning to have a situation where the cause and effect chain is becoming much, much more short range. In other words, something happens, you can immediately see the bad effect because the reserve fund is exhausted. Now this is very good, as far as I'm concerned, it's a very optimistic kind of thing because it means that the masses, most people who don't tend to look at things in a rather long range viewpoint because they're not really that interested, for one thing. Now see that the thing is evident. Like the price control thing, in one metaphor. And we had the first price freeze in August 71. And those of us who are free market economists were leaping up and down and shouting, saying, this thing can't work, and nobody paying attention to us at all. The whole world, the whole country at least, loved the price freeze. It was great, it was terrific. Businessmen loved it, labor leaders loved it, economists even sold out and loved it. And because the economists are supposed to be against them, every economist except Galbraith before August 15, 71 said price controls are ridiculous, they can't work. As soon as August 15th comes, all the economists rush into print, with the exception of Friedman, and say, this is great, this is terrific, et cetera, et cetera. So everybody loves it, and it didn't work that quickly, because there was a lot of slack in the economy. It was during a recession period, and so these shortages didn't show up that quickly. The frozen price was not that much below the free market price. But this, things began to leak out a little bit, and fissures began to show in the system, and so Nixon goes over to phase two. Now he reimposes a price freeze in the current situation, a couple of years later, where the economy is booming, there's no slack at all left, and immediately meat shortages develop, and margarine shortages, and so forth, et cetera, et cetera. So the cause and effect relationship, the length of time between initiating the evil cause and garnering the evil effect is becoming much, much shorter. Now he reimposes a price freeze in the current situation, a couple of years later, where the economy is booming, there's no slack at all left, and immediately meat shortages develop and margarine shortages and so forth, et cetera, et cetera. So the cause and effect relationship, the length of time between initiating the evil cause and garnering the evil effect is becoming much, much shorter. So we have this is sort of like teaching kids, I guess. I'm not exactly expert in kid teaching, but teaching kids is supposed to be very important to show the cause and effect relationship very quickly. So you don't have to bother with a long chain of resultant consequences, et cetera, et cetera. You have to have the thing be dramatic and short run and immediate. And this condition of immediacy is now becoming general throughout the system. Let me try to go through some of these areas. What we're seeing in the United States certainly is what we can call a crisis of liberalism. It's a crisis of liberal-conservatism. Liberalism, progressivism, state monopoly capital, whatever you want to call the system, corporate liberalism, has been really running the system at least since the 30s, and I think we've shown also really in the wider sense since the progressive period. And the reserve fund is being exhausted. In other words, cause and effect is now catching up the cause. And all throughout the system, we see breakdowns and crises, which are becoming more and more aggravated. What are some of them? Well, they're almost all over the place. I mentioned before already the public school system, which only 30 years ago was absolutely beloved. I mean, really beloved. And you couldn't attack it at all. And now everybody's attacking it. It's generally accepted that the whole thing is just not working. It's a miserable, rotten mess. That's one area. Crime in the streets, the whole urban question, urban decay, is getting so evident that one of the big jokes for talk shows is, with New York, can't walk down the streets in New York. It's a little exaggerated on the talk shows, but the drift is clearly there. So the whole urban question, which is solely a function of government, I mean, government has been handling, if you look at the crime on the streets question, every aspect of crime on the streets has been totally the responsibility of government all this time. The police are government police, the streets are government streets, the courts are government courts, the police are the prisons are government prisons. The whole thing is government, and yet the whole thing is collapsing. Not yet, of course. Therefore, the air pollution question is and water pollution is a question of pure government responsibility. The government courts have been deciding, the government's been owning the rivers all this time, and the government's been, the courts are deciding the air pollution question, who could dump water into the air and so forth. And of course the regulatory commissions and all that stuff, all these things we've been talking about all week, is getting more and more evident these things are collapsing. Liberals who used to love the ICC or the CAB now acknowledge, of course, these things are all terrible and it's a melange of cartelization, etc. And the railroads are collapsing and all over the place. We have more and more, and especially, of course, the most governmentally affected, regulated, or controlled areas, more and more of this kind of collapse. More broadly, we have the tax question. I really think, maybe this is wishful thinking, but I really think that we've politically reached a tax ceiling in this country. I mean, we've gotten to the point where the government does not dare to put on to increase the income tax, for example. I mean, just there's a tax rebellion in the United States which takes many different forms. Things like voting down school bonds, which used to be fantastically outside the pale to vote against it. In various areas where the public can vote directly, they vote down the tax kind of things. So the income tax, I think, is pretty well, at least looks like it's pretty well reached a ceiling. The government cannot politically raise it. Property tax is under severe attack for the first time in many years. There's even talk of abolishing property tax, reducing it. Certainly, they can't increase it very much. The VAT has been stopped at the pass. That was very important because the value-added tax, which Nixon was first toying with the idea of value-added tax. It was a very sinister tax, basically because it was hidden and nobody would know about it. And they think that the reason why businessmen are suddenly charging these increased prices is because of business greed. It would have been very, very difficult to convince the public, no, it's because the VAT has been imposed each step of the way from the manufacturer to the processor, etc. So Nixon tries the VAT, and this is during the Nixon honeymoon, this is before Watergate, and there's a big hullabaloo arises in Congress, and he withdraws the whole plan. So we have, I think, a pretty well political tax ceiling. There's also the inflationary route, but inflationary route is now catching up, as I've been saying this week. You can pump in the inflationary engine for a long time. Let me give you this little example about the German inflation, because I think it's very relevant. Social Security tax, which starts off as a great bonanza for the guys who have become 65 in 1 year. It looks like, you know, this is a fantastic giveaway. Now, of course, the young people are locked into it, and tax benefit and the tax rates keep going up every year, so that this is... it's going to keep going up, because the bonanza is only a very short-run bonanza. The guys who... Look, if you're 60, so-called Social Security insurance, if you're 64 in 1936 or whenever that thing passes, and in 1 year you reach to be 65, you get the full benefits. So obviously these guys, this windfall group is now passed out of the picture, and now the full weight of Social Security is beginning to be increasingly evident to the public. So the German inflation thing, what happens is, the first years of the German inflation, in other words, from 1914 to 1922, approximately that, the money supply keeps going up, something like that. But prices are going up less. They're going up less. And why are they going up significantly less than the money supply? Because the German public, the poor, deluded German public, thinks that the inflation is purely a wartime phenomenon. It's because of war. As soon as the war is over, it'll get back to normal, get back to the old price level. They don't get back to the old price, but they keep thinking this for quite a while. This whole mystique of normalcy after the war and all that stuff will get back to the old price level. And so they save up, they don't buy washing machines and all that, and they're waiting for prices to fall. Then they begin to realize as time goes on, the psyche of the public changes, they begin to realize that nothing's going to fall, and prices are going to keep going up, and then the thing changes, and as the money supply keeps going up, there's a crossover, and prices begin to rise faster than the money supply. And you get the situation where the boobs in the German Reichsbank were issuing statements saying, don't worry about it, we hear on all sides there's a money shortage, because the people are clamoring about the fact that they haven't got enough money to buy the goods, which are now being priced astronomically high. And the German government said, don't worry about it, Reichsbank. We have the printing presses working all night long. We're keeping night shifts to pour enough money out of the public. And of course, this accelerates the spiral even more. But the point is that inflation, the point I want to make here is now is, inflation is a great thing, seemingly great thing in the early years of inflation. In the early years of inflation, interest rates are low, and prices aren't going up that much, and it seems like a big boom period and so forth and so on. In the later years of the inflation, retribution begins to catch up. In other words, an effect begins to catch up the cause. Prices start going up faster, something like exponentially at this point. Prices start going up faster, interest rates start going up, you can't push them down, wage rates begin to catch up, prices where they've been falling behind before, creating inflationary profits. And so the crunch comes, and there's no way out. And as these effects occur, the high interest rates occur, and the higher costs occur, and the higher prices, the public begins to get very irritated, as you, of course, have seen. Of course, the first step is lashing out and saying, freeze everything. But not only doesn't it work, it's becoming evident that it doesn't work. That something else has to happen. So we see, of course, in the public school system and the racial integration attempts, etc., of course, an enormous amount of headaches and conflict. So we see all through the system increasing crises. And these crises are systemic, they're inherent in the status system, and they're getting more and more evident. See, I would analyze it as effect catching up with cause. The fat has now been taken off, the reserve fund has been exhausted. From now on, it's an accelerating effect, because every time a new status measure comes in, we're going to get a new bango kind of response out of it, bad response out of it. Okay. So things are getting progressively worse, will continue to get worse because of these status measures are now reaching their effect, as the fat is accordionized, and we now have the effects coming out from the causes. Getting back to the Marxists, and I enjoy reading Marxist-Leninist literature. Of course, there's a point, you know, when you sort of get up your eyebrows with the jargon and so forth. But one of the reasons I enjoy Marxist-Leninist literature is the Marxist-Leninists, even though I disagree completely with their goals, about the only group that has been talking about and thinking about social change for the last 100 years or so. In other words, they're the only radical group of any substance who've been spending a lot of time thinking about strategy, thinking about social change. Of course, this what we're confronted with tonight is why should I be optimistic or why should Forrest be pessimistic? In other words, we're talking about analyses or theories or predictions of social change. I think the Marxists have been remarkably successful in effecting social change, not in the United States, of course, but if you look at the world picture. Especially considering the holes in the theory, holes in the doctrine. So I think it's important to study the literature, find out what they've been saying, how do they think. In other words, if libertarians have a radically different system than is now in power, which we do, and the Marxists have a radically different system than is now in power, what have the Marxists been saying? How do they think social change can be effective? Well, one of the things they say is, two particular things. One thing they say is there's a ruling class. And of course, libertarians, in my view, believe there's a ruling class, but we have a different view than what the ruling class is. We don't believe the capitalists rule the workers. One of the reasons why the Marxists say we don't have revolution by the oppressed classes, by the subject classes, or the majority, is because the oppressed class suffers from what they call false consciousness. In other words, they think that they're really being benefited by the king or whatever. So therefore, the task so how do they get to the true consciousness? How do they find out about reality? How do they find out they're being oppressed by the nobles or the king or the Marxian terms of capitalists? The way they find out about it is by intellectuals telling them about it. That's one way. In other words, you need a cadre or a group of self-aware, dedicated professional intellectuals of some sort who are dedicated to enlightening the public, enlightening particularly the oppressed classes. There's no really need to enlighten the ruling class. I mean, they might be enlightened or not, but the point is to enlighten the oppressed classes so they'll do something about it. And to give them the message and show them how they're being oppressed, etc. In this way, their blinkers are taken off and they will become enlightened to their own subjection. And one of the problems of this, and the Marxists, of course, face the fact pretty quickly, mostly the masses just aren't interested. They really don't give a damn about all this stuff about the ruling class and the workers and the capitalists and so forth and so on. There's a lot of fretting going on among Marxists with these people. Here we are trying to help these SOBs, and they're not even interested. So the point then becomes, in the Marxist-Leninist strategy, that there has to be a reason for them to get interested. After all, most of the public are not professional political theorists. They don't really care that much about the whole business. They're whatever the Russian or German equivalent of watching television, that sort of stuff, and going bowling. It's a major interest. There's really nothing wrong with that. There's no real reason why they should be great political theorists or be interested in political theory. However, there's a problem that is they're being oppressed and all the rest of us are being oppressed. And we'd like to enlighten them on this subject. The point is, this kind of enlightenment, this kind of spread of enlightenment, so to speak, to the oppressed classes, can really only take place, as the Marxists began to realize, if two conditions are met. Conditions which really mean that their attention is caught. I mentioned before that they have to catch the attention of somebody to get them to learn something if he's not really interested. So these conditions really amount to the masses or the oppressed classes or whatever being forced, in quotes, to get interested in the topic. For this, you need two conditions, what Marxists call objective conditions and subjective conditions. It's peculiar terminology. It's I guess, Hegelian terminology. I don't think I argue Hegel. At any rate, the terminology is objective and subjective conditions. What the Marxists mean by objective conditions is the conditions have to be ripe. In other words, there have to be a lot of things happening, breakdowns in the system. What they call crises situations, either wars or defeat in a war or runaway inflation or depression or whatever. Now this is an attention-getting device. In other words, a breakdown in the system is a big attention-getting device. People suddenly get interested in the problem. During the 30s, everybody got interested in unemployment. Why is there unemployment? What's going on? Why is there a business cycle? This doesn't mean there's any great theorizing emanating from the 30s. The point is, a mass of the public, for the first and last time in their lives, got interested in business cycle theory. So the point is, crisis situations create the objective conditions for the success of radical social change. And what I'm trying to say here is that the objective conditions are increasingly being fulfilled in the United States and are going to be more and more going to be fulfilled as the effect is more and more going to catch up with the cause, as the prophecies of Spencer, Pareto, et cetera, are going to be fulfilled, and more evidently so. As taxes get more and more crippling, as inflation gets more and more crippling, as the urban mess gets worse and worse, et cetera, et cetera. The whole business. Oh, I should also add here foreign policy, of course, a special lagniappe. The Wilsonian foreign policy, collective security, and that whole business is obviously going down the drain. That clearly and patently has failed. The idea of fixing everybody up all over the world, going to cooperate. So the whole liberal system, the whole corporate liberal system is in a state of aggravated collapse, and more evidently so to the public. Okay, so the objective conditions for radical social change are not only being more and more fulfilled, and increasingly so in the last 10, 15 years or so, but these conditions will be more and more ripe as time goes on. In other words, the future is great for the increasing presence of the objective conditions. What about the subjective condition? Marxists mean in this peculiar term, subjective conditions, means essentially people to carry the message. In other words, you need the breakdown, and you need the people to carry the message. The people, of course, the cadre, or the hardcore, or whatever it's called, Lenin called the professional revolutionaries, is a dramatic term. In other words, what is really meant is a group of self-conscious intellectuals who offer the alternative. Now, in other words, people will say, look, see, the system is breaking down, right? And here's why it's broken down. We can show you how it all fits in, and why we predicted this before. We can show you our writings 20 years ago that predicted inflation, and so forth and so on, the whole business. And the theory then is that the public increasingly turns to these guys who have shown themselves to have predicted correctly, and have shown an answer that makes sense to this problem, which has been called forcibly to the attention of the masses by this breakdown in the system. If the objective or conditions for the success of liberty are great and getting better, what about the subjective conditions? Well, here I'm not going to stand here and say that libertarianism has become a mighty force in the land, but I think certainly the rate of increase has been fantastic. And for those of us who are veterans in the movement, not only 20 years ago, but 5, 7-something years ago, the number of libertarians in the Eastern Seaboard was just about, you know, could fit comfortably in my own small living room, usually did. 5, 6, something like that. And these are 5, 6 brilliant theoreticians, but they ain't got no movement out there. Okay, of any sort. And then 1969 is the famous takeoff. I mean, famous within the movement, the famous takeoff, and all of a sudden, young people are suddenly flocking in the movement in great numbers, and this is exponentially accelerating. I'm not saying this exponentially accelerating trend will continue, but all I can say is, reporting as an historian at this point, that from 1969 through 1973 has been an enormous rapid rate of increase in the number of libertarians. It's gotten to this point. You see, it's gotten to the point. As a Marxist friend of mine, of course, was sneering at this whole thing. I haven't got any people there. We're fulfilling one of the conditions of the Marxists say. We're now fulfilling the conditions where somebody writes a libertarian article of some merit in some publication which I barely heard of, and I haven't heard of this person. Now, this is a big thing for the ideological movement. In other words, up until a couple of years ago, I knew every libertarian in the country, and if somebody writes an article, this is J.R. Jones or something, I would know who this guy is, and et cetera, et cetera. Now people are popping up all over the place who I've never heard of before, who are plugged into the whole thing, who don't need to be hashed over and educated, et cetera, and brainwashed, et cetera. In other words, they suddenly pop up all over, and this is true all over the country. So so I find this an exciting development. I'm not going to predict victory on the basis of that, but certainly consistent with the idea that victory is a coming. Then we had... We had different organizations. We started off as our only organization for several years was a campus-based organization, which is what the New Left had encountered. The New Left was never able to break out of the campus, even at its height, which they were much more numerous than we are at this point. But they were never able to break out of the campus. Somebody graduates from the campus. He's a big leader of SDS. And he's a senior. 1 year later, he's completely dropped out. He's off somewhere. And they found it impossible to mobilize to go to the next step and get an adult group. We now have some adult groups. The Libertarian Party, which started last March, which I figured was a quasi-joke, in the sense that here we're 200 libertarians in the country and we're running a presidential candidate. What kind of nonsense is that? But it's been growing very rapidly in every state, even after the presidential election. So every state now has a nest of libertarians. They're largely highly intelligent. They're active, dedicated, etc. They're popping up everywhere and in different communities all over the state. We have a Buffalo chapter, for example, just started, et cetera, et cetera. Not only that, but our presidential candidate, a distinguished philosopher, got an electoral vote last year. This is undoubtedly the cheapest electoral vote per dollar in the history of the United States. And they had a campaign fund, I don't know, $500 or something like that. And you got an electoral vote for that. $500 per vote is pretty darn good. So we have that as a groundwork, and not only that, but the reception I get as a veteran in the movement is an amazing change in the sort of reception I get from average intellectuals and professors, etc. 20 years ago, these ideas were dismissed as being fascist, Neanderthal, reactionary, Paleolithic, etc., etc. And now the same sort of people, same liberal intellectual types, say, "Well, you know, it's pretty interesting. I really believe most of that," and so forth. Now, whether they really believe most of that or not, another story, but they think they do, which is, I think, a great step forward. From having the whole thing treated as a reactionary Neanderthal fascist, etc., they say, yeah, that's pretty good. How do you think the courts will work and all that sort of stuff? You know? I mean, you get the sort of technical questions, and the general matrix of libertarian policy and program seems to be very much widely accepted. We've been getting a lot on radio and television. One of the friend of mine is also a libertarian in New York, and I were comparing notes over couple of radio interview programs, and we were both amused by the fact that instead of being attacked bitterly by guys being fascist and heartless and all that, they say, "Yeah, you believe what are your views on this?" And you tell them your views, crazy views on that. I say, "Yeah, that's interesting. What's your views on that?" And sort of reverential questioning. I was on the John Wingate All Night program a couple of weeks ago, and I thought Mike and would be hassle, etc. And And at first, before the program starts, you know, while the commercial is on, he said, and he's not, you know, he's a regular talk show person, not in no sense a libertarian activist of any sort. And first, before the thing is starting, he says, by the way, what are your views on taxes? This is around April 15th, so he was, his attention had been forcibly called over the tax problem. He says, what are your views on taxes? I said, I'm against them. He says, all of them? I said, yes, all of them. He said, good. Now there's somebody, who's ready for the march, you know, for the grand march. And you find this all over the place. I mean, it's really fantastic, in my own experience, to find this sort of, reaction among the public. So I think the time is ripe. I think, and libertarians, I say, proliferating all over the place. The receptivity on the part of the public is fantastically proved. He quit at 5. So the general cultural receptivity is much greater, and the media. That's true that the media has not been converted, obviously. But you're beginning to get this sort of thing. I mean, Forrest was asking this morning, how do you get the media? Well, I mean, look, we've had a situation in the old days. I mean, 5, 10, 15, 20 years ago, the sort of books we write were published by the, you know, the Archon Press or something like that. Either privately published, handcrafted, and no margin, and that sort of thing, or else some very obscure publisher didn't have a distribution facility and so forth. And now we're getting published by Macmillan and Harper and Row and Harcourt Brace and all that sort of stuff. Now, it's true this could be a fad. On the other hand, the very fact that even if it's a fad, it's a good thing. Since the establishment or the media consider us important enough or interesting enough or whatever to become a fad. Macmillan, the august publishing house of Macmillan and Company this year published no less than 3 libertarian books, which is, I mean, it's fantastic. It's true they're not pushing some of them very hard, but they published them, and there they are, and Harcourt, Harper and Row, a couple, et cetera, et cetera. So all over the place we see this kind of thing happen. Even Penthouse magazine is now at work, article about the movement, the libertarian movement, and a sympathetic article, since the guy who's writing is also libertarian. So these things are, so we're beginning to permeate the culture, so to speak. Now what we do afterward, the precise path by which we ride to victory, I haven't yet blocked out in my own mind. Obviously, we haven't got that many people yet, so the thing has become an important consideration. But I think that my basic view of strategy, my basic view of why I'm optimistic, I think should be pretty clear by this time. That the world, one big thing I left out. An important part of the story, which I shouldn't omit before I stop. While all this is going on in the United States, while the objective conditions are proliferating in the United States, and while the subjective conditions are proliferating at a lesser but a more rapid rate, what's going on in the communist countries? I've already said Marxism has conquered half the world. What's going on there? Well, there are some of the most exciting developments in the 20th century, in my view, are developing there, which has gotten very little attention, a little bit of attention in the Western press, but very, very little relative to its importance. And the great hero, from our concern, this whole process, is Marshal Tito. Now, Marshal Tito has gotten a little crotchety at this point. So I don't endorse his recent actions. But the point is, Marshal Tito has ridden to power in 1945, during World War II. He's ridden to power with his own army, his own guerrilla army. So he's not completely beholden to Stalin. But here you have an international communist system, which Stalin was the guru, and everybody took orders from him. And naturally, he apes the Russian system when he gets in. He puts on a full collectivized system. Collectivizes everything, has a communist party run everything, the Politburo and the National Planning Board and everything else. There's a full Russian collectivist model, abolishing private enterprise, abolishing price system, etc. But what he sees, even though Yugoslavia is not really industrialized at this point, but even with their small amount of industry, what he sees is that the collectivized planning system wasn't working. And he saw this before anybody else in the communist bloc. He didn't see it, interestingly enough, because he read Mises or myself or whatever. He saw it because it wasn't working. The planning wasn't working. Everything was being messed up. And so in one of the great, one of the heroic actions of modern times in the political economic sphere, Marshal Tito launches the process of desocialization. Now, here's another possible, and Forrest has been talking about, and I've been talking about, this cumulative, this very depressing cumulative thing, where the state gets worse and worse, because every time, as Mises has always pointed out, if you have one intervention in the system, the government intervenes at one point, say in the farm price thing, this messes up the system. You're trying to solve a problem by intervening. But this messes up the system. You create two other problems. Then you're faced with a choice. Either you repeal the whole thing and go back to square one, or else you have two other interventions to try to cure the two problems, but this creates two more problems, et cetera, et cetera. And you wind up with a full statist system, which doesn't work very well either. But the point is, this process can also be reversed. And we always knew in theory this could be reversed. We always knew in theory that you could start with statism, and have a step-by-step rolling back and freeing each sector, as the problem develops, you say, well, I guess we have to liberate this sector now in order to get that thing to work. Now, this, we always knew this in theory, but it seemed to be utopian, the idea this could actually happen in practice, because historically, all we saw was the process working the other way, at least in the modern world. But Marshall Tito launches the process of systematic step-by-step, not so gradual either, radical step-by-step de-statization. This is what they call it, by the way, de-statization. And in 1948, and by 1952, in just a few years, he established a market kind of socialism, which is a fantastic kind of breakthrough. What you had was, first of all, they had a private sector. It was very strong. Agriculture was essentially private now in Yugoslavia. It has been since 48, I think. Agriculture is private. There's a private sector of small businesses. In those days, hiring, I'd say, up to five people, something like that, which was private. And the so-called public sector was denationalized, and the workers in each plant owned each plant, sort of like producers' co-ops. They don't officially own the plant, but they do in practice. It's called social ownership. Interestingly enough, you see, the Yugoslavs distinguish between social ownership, in contrast to the Russians, distinguish between social ownership and state ownership, and they're consciously anti-statist. One of the speeches that Tito made in the early days, he said, look, he says, Stalin keeps talking about the withering of the way of the state. It's not, that was another phrase which Clinton didn't want to originate it. Stalin keeps talking about the withering away of the state, but the state ain't withering away. The state's getting bigger and bigger in Russia. So it seems to be there's another way of withering away the state, and that's to start withering it. It was to start de-statizing, getting the state off the backs of the public. So Tito does this in a great leap in 1948. So by 52, we have this new system, worker ownership or worker of the each socialized plant, so to speak, and then a free price system between the plants and a profit and loss test for each plant, and plowing back of profits, et cetera, et cetera. Also, the banking system gets decentralized, and the banks are essentially owned not by the government but by the consumers, by the sort of consumer co-op banks owned by the various firms. So we have a system that looks very much like quasi-capitalism. As a matter of fact, even before 67, even this phase two of the first big phase of de-statization, Yugoslavia was probably less socialist than France. It's a way of toss-up. But the interesting thing is as they began to do this, as they began to free each sector, they found the problems began to be eliminated. They found that here's a problem with steel or something, and they have free pricing in the steel industry and profit and loss test, and then the steel problems clear up. And so they got more and more excited about the process, and the process began to accelerate. Finally, in 1967, there was a third phase, which went over to even much more free market thing in Yugoslavia, where you have a price system that's completely freed, virtually. Profit and loss tests are even more stringent. A firm can now go bankrupt if they lose money. And the state control of investment, which was the last big state control, and Mises has always said that if you want to know whether a country is socialist, look at who controls, basic investment. Before this, the state had taxed each firm, something like 70% of its income, and had taken all this money and decided on who will get what allocation of capital, which plant should be built where. In the reforms of 1967-68, the state income tax on plants was reduced from something like 70% to something like 20%, which is less than the United States. So you get so now the investment has been freed also from the state, from statism. So you really have a very close to a free market system. One of the things that happens, one of the exciting things also is the ideology of the Yugoslav communists. I've read some of the I don't read Serbo-Croat, but I have read quite a bit of the English translations of Yugoslav communist theoreticians. And what they're saying is, they're very excited about the idea of free market, and they're reading Friedman and Mises, etc., and they agree with it. And one of the things they, and they're trying to apply them free market principles, libertarian principles, systematically wherever they can find any kind of anomaly or problem. And you have them sounding like, very much of this stuff sounds very much like you know, right-wing republicanism in the United States, sort of like Barry Goldwater or Ronald Reagan. For example, you read the communist economists. The economists have essentially been in the forefront, I'm happy to say, of this liberalization or free marketization. You read a typical Slovene or Croat. Slovenes and Croats, but here's ethnic determinism coming in also. For various reasons, the Serbs have always been the SOBs in Yugoslavia, and the statists. And the Slovenes and the Croats are the most industrialized, thriftiest, et cetera, most entrepreneurial. So the Slovenes and Croats have been on the forefront of this liberal destatization. And when you read a Slovene or Croat communist economist, I say he sounds like Barry Goldwater or Ronald Reagan, but he says things like this. There shouldn't be any what they call political factories. We shouldn't have the state taxing us and building factories in Montenegro, an underdeveloped part of Yugoslavia. Because why should we, the thrifty entrepreneurial types in Slovenia or Croatia, why should we be taxed to support those lazy Slavs down in Montenegro? Or you know, or the Albanian part of Yugoslavia. So the whole analysis and the whole way of looking at things is individual, it's a free market. And the philosophic front, the Yugoslavs are now talking in terms of that the individual should not have to sacrifice himself to the social welfare, the social benefit, which is a tremendous thing for Marxists, supposed Marxists to say. And now they're talking about, well, the latest thrust of what they're talking about. Oh, one of the things is politically they're so decentralized that, for example, Slovenia, which is a part of Yugoslavia, can make its own consular treaties with Austria, which are treaties which do not apply to the rest of Yugoslavia. It's something like the Articles of Confederation. It's almost unbelievable for a current modern country, you know, especially for a communist country. And there are things like foreign investment. They welcome foreign investment. They won't welcome American investment in Yugoslavia and so forth and so on. They're trying to get back to a hard money, to the dinar. They want a freely convertible dinar. There's even talk about going over to a gold standard dinar eventually. And reporters who go to Belgrade, especially to Zagreb, which of course being Croat is better than Belgrade. When they go into the Yugoslavia, they find a fantastic spirit, very different from the gray, dead spirit of in Russia and Eastern Europe. And people, there's a lot of food in the shops, and people are happy and so forth and so on. So the whole kind of bourgeois spirit is now taking over Yugoslavia as well as the bourgeois economics. One of the things they're also trying to push, although they admit there's going to be some problem getting the old communist functionaries to accept it, is to have a stock market. See, one of the things is this: the workers own the plant, but they're facing this kind of a problem. He have 200 workers in the plant, but what happens if one worker retires? Why shouldn't he continue to have a vote? All right, and what happens? And why shouldn't he be able to pass his share on to his children? Of course, this means a stock market. It means each individual worker should have his pro rata share, and then he should be allowed to sell it or give it away. So they're talking in terms of the stock market, and they're realizing, well, it's going to be kind of tough to get the old Communist Party hacks to accept it. So they propose to call it, and get this, Socialist People's Capitalism. So they can't call it capitalism, obviously. That's the one thing that they're ideologically barred from that. Outside of that, they're virtually going all the way. Now, there has been some setbacks since life proceeds in a zigzag path, not a unilinear process. Some setbacks in the last 6 months or a year or so, Tito has gotten very upset at what he calls anarcho-liberalism among Yugoslav intellectuals and Yugoslav economy. He's trying to go back a little bit to a little bit more statism. But it seems to me when Tito dies, which he will eventually, supposedly someday, that the thing is going to bust open and they're going to go have a big march back onwards to free marketization or destatization. I had an interesting experience along this line. Well, what happens is that Yugoslavia set the great beacon light for the rest of Eastern Europe. So that after a few years of seeing how the Yugoslav economy was developing and doing much better than the rest of Eastern Europe, Poland and Czechoslovakia and Hungary Bulgaria a little bit. Poland, Czechoslovakia, and Hungary began to shift over and began to follow in the path blazed by Yugoslavia. But they had a lot more problems, obviously. One of the reasons, by the way, why Czechoslovakia was reinvaded by Russia was not only because of the democracy aspect, but because Czechoslovakia was going to make the full leap virtually to the Yugoslav position. And Stalin was seriously considering invading Yugoslavia when Tito broke with him. He didn't do it because Tito threatened to fight forever on the hills. And it's just the great Yugoslav guerrilla tradition, so he didn't feel like he was trying to come back. But at any rate, it seems to me the process is more and more inevitable. What's happening is that it's a standard joke among economists that when you have a world economic or European economic conference, the Western economists are talking about the glories of Keynesianism and planning, and the communist economists are talking about the glories of the free market. I had an interesting experience when I was teaching comparative economic systems. This is about 66, 67, during the height of the big reform push. And I was talking the whole term about the glories of the free market and the evils of socialism and state planning, et cetera, et cetera. And finally, to appease the kids and so forth, we're getting a little restive at this point, I said, okay, we'll get another side of the picture. We're bringing this guy as a top Hungarian economic historian. I was here on an exchange fellowship for a year. He'll give you his side of the story, from Hungary, communists, et cetera. He gets up there, what does he do? He starts this whole lecture denouncing the central planning of socialism and praising the free market, which made our Maoist types very unhappy, to say the least. Eugen Leubel, the Czech communist economist who escaped from Czechoslovakia after the rollback, also came and lectured to us, and it was the same story. He was talking about the glories of freedom and free enterprise and whatever, and the evils of planning. It was the same sort of thing. So what I'm saying here is that I think the same situation is happening in a communist country. Interestingly enough, apparently not by a radical kind of one-shot change or revolution in any sense, but by a gradual, a cumulative de-statization. In Russia, the process has gotten more publicity, but it's been less effective. The so-called Liebermanism is really a flash in the pan. It's been very, very slow compared to Russia has had many more years to have frozen bureaucratic kind of setup, obviously, than Yugoslavia or Poland. But the point is that the process, I think, in Russia is going in the same direction, but it's going to take a much longer time. But Eastern Europe is the real flowering ground for this sort of process. China is going to take, of course, a much longer time, China being the still fundamentalist, the communist, and dedicated, etc. But as I think I said a few days ago, when this original generation of Chinese leaders die out, which presumably they will fairly soon, so they're all over 80 or something, there should be a loosening up of that, too, and back to what they call the capitalist road. I think that sort of rounds out. I could go on and talk about the third world, et cetera, and the land question, but this is enough for tonight, at least it's a lecture. I think the reasons for optimism, to wrap it up, are that we have this quantum leap, this great qualitative and quantitative leap with the Industrial Revolution, with everybody from the communist rightward now being committed one way or the other to industrialism, to maintaining the industrial system. And with that, just the conditions to maintain and flourish with industrialism, you have to have a free market. This knowledge is now permeating the general public and even intellectuals with the breakdown of Western liberalism, with the breakdown of neo-mercantilism, Western liberalism, increasingly accelerating, and with the breakdown of the socialist planning, which is even now being admitted by most socialists themselves. There are very few even socialists now who will defend, the new left historians, William Afton Williams, his group, don't talk about socialism. They say, the state's bad, we have to have some kind of decentralization. That's a big step forward from what they used to say back in the 30s. So there's a general revulsion against Leviathan state and against central planning and so forth, and so the whole communist apparatus, the whole communist kind of state planning is cracking up also. And so with this advance, with this acceleration of the objective conditions, with the processes of libertarian word change accelerating, with the growth of an active, intelligent, dedicated, self-aware libertarian movement, I see the future as being a noble one. Thank you.